There's nothing that fails like success. A quote by G.K. Chesterton. When you add to the truth, you subtract from it. A quote from the Talmud. God is best known by not knowing him. A quote from St. Augustine. I want to bring to your awareness this profound theme that I stumbled upon over the last year. And this is a theme that I see all across personal development and really all across life. Many different domains of life will fall under this theme. Some of the most interesting questions and topics in life will tend to go full circle. Now, what exactly I mean by full circle, I'll explain here in a minute. But what I don't mean is I don't mean a strange loop. So don't confuse this topic with the strange loop topic, which I talked about recently. In my mind, these are two separate things, although maybe there's sometimes a little bit of overlap here and there. But generally, I consider them different. So there's two meanings, really, in my mind for going full circle. The first meaning is the more conventional one and the one that we're really not interested in here. And then there's a second meaning. So the first meaning is something like the hero's journey, where a hero starts off at an origin point, like his little village. Then he goes off into the woods. He goes off to a new town, a new territory. He fights monsters and guardians and dragons, and he conquers the dragon in a faraway land. And then eventually he makes his way back to his original little village and sort of comes full circle. And there's a lot of examples like this. Many people's lives like that can go full circle. Like maybe you grew up in a little town, rural area of the country, and then you become a big shot businessman and you travel all around the world and you do all this big stuff. And then eventually you come back to the same little town and that's where you retire and ultimately die. And that's a nice little neat way to wrap up your life. Puts a bow on things. That's why it's a common trope in movies and in stories and in books. But that's not what I mean by going full circle. What I mean is something a little bit more interesting and paradoxical. The second meaning of full circle is if you imagine a spectrum, and on this spectrum you have two polar opposites. So let's just use black and white, the colors. And then you have all the shades of gray in between. Usually what we assume is that the way the spectrum works is that it's kind of linear. Like you can go from black to gray to white and get to pure white. And then there's like a wall that you hit there at pure white. You can't get whiter than pure white. And you're certainly not going to get black by going further down that road. And the same thing by going in this direction towards the black. You're not going to get blacker than pure black. And what I mean by going full circle is that actually you can. So imagine if we take this spectrum and we connect the ends such that gray is at the top, white is down here, and black is down here right next to each other, basically at the exact same point. And then everything in between here is a gradient. Such that if you start at pure black, you go all the way around to the top of gray, and then you come back down towards pure white, and you go further, you're going to go full circle from pure white to pure black. And that's a really interesting dynamic, because if that's possible, and I'm not saying this is possible everywhere, I'm saying there are instances where in life you tend to find this. That's a big shift. You see, there's an inflection point there. It's almost this gigantic discontinuous jump, because here you are, you're just moving through shades of gray on both sides, but going from pure black to pure white, wow, that tends to be a mind fuck. That tends to be unexpected, and that tends to be a big gear shift in your life. So it's worth thinking about where these kinds of situations might lurk in life. So let me give you some frivolous examples of this, some cute ones that I thought of. So what I mean when I say going full circle is the following. For example, a work of art that is so bad, it's good. A joke that's so unfunny, it becomes funny. A life that's so easy, it's hard. A lie so bold, everyone believes it. A plan so crazy, it just might work. A pain so great, it actually becomes enjoyable. A war so devastating that it brings lasting peace. A truth so strange, it's easier to tell a lie than that truth. A person so well-educated, he's stupid. Getting so much rest that it actually makes you sick. A fact that's so obvious it goes unnoticed. A strategy so crafty it looks foolish. An insight so simple only a genius could have it. A letter so concise it took days to write. A guy who's such a jerk, you can't help but love him. That one's for the ladies. You know what I'm talking about. Or how about this one? Someone you disagree with so much that you can't stop listening to him. That might be true of some crazy right-wing radio show host. How about a prohibition that's so strict it makes you want to break it? Like if you tell a child, whatever you do, never look inside that box. Never look in there. Of course he's going to want to look in there. How about this example? A man so masculine, he's not afraid to look feminine. A motivation so strong, it's paralyzing. Or this one, if you've ever been in a serious car accident, you have so little time to think that time stands still, and you have all the time in the world. A situation so tragic, it's comical. An incident so unremarkable, it's remarkable. A plant so soft, it never breaks. A man acting so ordinary, he arouses suspicion. A star so massive, it collapses into a black hole. A loss so significant, you stop caring. So those would be some cute, cheeky examples that I thought of. These aren't the real bulk of the examples that I want to share with you, which I've been collecting over the last year. At first, it started off with just a few examples, but then I was using this sort of lens, this filter, to look at this theme of going full circle, and I was looking at all the stuff I was studying in different fields, and I just started to see it popping up again and again and again. All this stuff keeps coming full circle, and some of the most profound stuff works this way. It's quite amazing. It's rather paradoxical. It seems like reality is able to invert itself, to flip itself inside out in counterintuitive ways. And of course, as you've heard me talking about a lot in prior episodes, this theme of counterintuitiveness, this also tends to be a very significant theme within all of personal development. And a lot of people get themselves cornered in life because they do the intuitive thing and not the counterintuitive thing. And a lot of success in business, in dating, in spirituality, in personal development, in all this sort of stuff, depends upon you seeing the counterintuitive move and being able to make it. So what I hope is that by pointing out these themes to you, you then develop the filter to see and find your own examples and then make the interconnections. And then you become much better at predicting how life really works. And then, of course, you can more easily design the kind of life that you want. So that's the ultimate goal with talking about this stuff. So let's move on to my list of examples. I have a lot of them. I have dozens of them. But perhaps the most prototypical of all, the one that epitomizes this entire theme of going full circle, is atheism versus theism. And a long time ago, maybe a year ago or so on my blog, I actually posted a post about this. I drew a diagram, and it was a circle. And what it showed atheism and theism as two poles on the spectrum, but then it loops back around. And what the atheist and the theist do not understand is that really, one flips into the other, and that they are not as opposite as it would seem. See, the atheist thinks that there is no God. The theist thinks there is a God, and they think that nothing could be more opposite than that. But actually, they're both half right and they're both half wrong. And both of them end up getting mindfucked because of this coming of full circle that happens. So the atheist believes there is no God, but what the atheist doesn't understand is if you take atheism all the way past that inflection point, then what you discover is that there is a God, but that God is nothingness. Now, the atheist will say, well, Leo, that's already what I believe and thought. What's the difference between believing there is no God versus saying God is nothingness? Isn't that the same thing? No, not at all. They're actually almost opposite. Now, the theist will say, wait a minute, Leo, but what are you saying here? So there is a God? So then I'm right, as the theist. No, actually, as a theist, you're wrong. Because, see, the theist believes that there is a God, but the theist has silly notions of what the God is. Believes that God is some kind of formed thing. What the theist doesn't want to accept is that God is nothing. Because to the theist, to accept that God is nothing, well, that would be no different than atheism. And of course, the theist is not an atheist. He doesn't like atheism. He's opposed to that. So of course, there must be a God, and God could be anything, but he can't be nothing. See? But the two actually go full circle. When you become so theistic that you actually have a direct experience of God, you will realize God is nothing. And that will be a huge mindfuck for you. On the other hand, if you're an atheist and you become even more atheistic and you have a direct experience of nothingness, true nothingness, not your ideas of nothingness, not your beliefs in no God, that's not nothingness, actual nothingness, you will discover that that's actually God. And that there's a good reason why it's called God and not nothingness. Although both names are appropriate, they highlight different facets of the same thing. And this has actually been a real problem for both atheists and theists. For theists, it's a problem because actually there's examples of Christian mystics who lived in monasteries, and they were just monks before they were mystics, before they became enlightened, before they experienced God. And so they just had a bunch of Catholic beliefs, let's say, about God. And then they go pray and they do all their meditation and prayer-like practices. They live an ascetic lifestyle. They're very hardcore about how they live. They cloister themselves. And eventually through this practice, because it's almost like they're meditating so much, that they break through to a direct experience of God. But they discover that there's nothing there. It's completely nothing. It's completely blank. It's completely empty. Reality is groundless. God is completely groundless. That's what God is. But to them, this is such a horror, such a shock, because what Christianity has taught them is that God is the opposite of that. See, so this doesn't make sense to them. They don't see how God could flip back around into nothingness. And likewise for the atheist. If the atheist ever has a direct experience of what we're calling God here, not a man in the sky, but God, the real deal, which is possible to have. For example, if you take 30 milligrams of 5-MeO-DMT, you will have this experience. And if you're an atheist, what will happen to you is a very similar thing that happened to me, is that you will flip back around and go past the inflection point, but from the other end that the Christian mystics do. See? So you will experience the nothingness, but the nothingness will be so full and so infinite and so godlike. Not as a man in the sky with a beard, but so godlike in other qualities, like in the quality of infinite love, in the quality of consciousness and infinite intelligence, in the quality of being eternal, of being sentient, and all these other interesting qualities that you would not think consciousness or nothingness or could have. And then you realize that all your atheism was just nonsense. So you can have this experience. So this would be the perfect example of what I mean by things going full circle. Another really good example is hedonism versus asceticism. So the hedonist thinks of himself as on the opposite end of the spectrum from the ascetic. I mean, after all, what two people could be more further apart? The hedonist is chasing sex, food, travel, fast cars and hot girls and strip clubs and parties and drugs and alcohol and all this sort of stuff. And the ascetic is the exact opposite. The ascetic locks himself into a cave for a decade or more and just lives by himself, doesn't have any friends, doesn't do anything, doesn't shop, doesn't buy anything, doesn't have sex, takes these strict vows, doesn't eat any fancy food. And it would seem like to the hedonist, that's a terrible way to live life. Because after all, you've only got this moment. We should live up this moment and make the most of it to be as happy as possible, because that's the ultimate end of life, is to be happy, right? There's no afterlife, none of that nonsense. It's just let's live for the moment and be as happy as possible. But what does the hedonist discover if he does that? He actually discovers that if he follows through on that strategy, he ends up being the most miserable person in the world. He gets depressed. He gets lonely. He's never satisfied. Every single thing that he does never satisfies him. The best food, the hottest sex, the most expensive cars, they all just feel empty in the end. And so eventually he goes through a lot of suffering and he ends up being one of the most miserable people in the world. What happens to the ascetic? It would seem like the ascetic, maybe he is even in a worse situation because he's locked himself in a cave. Actually, meanwhile, what happens with the ascetic is that he becomes so introverted and so self-conscious of his true nature and of the nature of reality that he passes the inflection point. And actually, he experiences the greatest joy humanly possible. In fact, the joy that the ascetic experiences just by sitting and doing nothing is greater than the joy that a hedonist experiences if he is shooting up heroin or having the hottest sex or eating the bestest food or driving the coolest car. Those peak experiences for the hedonist are little blips on the radar screen of happiness for the ascetic. The ascetic knows peaks of happiness that the hedonist couldn't dream of in a million years. But he has to go through that inflection point. Of course, he has to work for it. It doesn't happen automatically. And so this is another example of things going full circle. It's very counterintuitive, you see. Because you might say that the hedonist strategy is actually to pursue happiness. No. The hedonist strategy really is to pursue misery. He just calls it happiness. The ascetic strategy is to pursue happiness. He will actually get it. But the problem is that to most people, the ascetic's strategy to pursue happiness, even though it's a real strategy and it will really actually work, to them, it looks like a recipe for suffering. And so they never even bother to consider it for themselves or take it seriously. Interesting how that works. It's pretty powerful to understand that, isn't it? It certainly puts a lot of stuff into perspective. It shows you how wrong people can be. People could just have a strategy that's 100% the opposite of what they think it is. And they could waste years, decades pursuing that strategy and be wondering, how come this isn't working? Well, of course, because you don't understand this non-linear dynamic within reality. How about this other example? Selfishness versus selflessness. It's rather similar to the previous example. So selfish people assume that the way that they become the happiest in life, the most secure, is by being very selfish, by being very greedy. So in their company, they will acquire all the resources, they will make schemes, they will manipulate to get the best position, to rise to the top, to become the CEO. And once they're the CEO, they try to get as much money as they can, the most stock options, all that sort of stuff. Or if they get a position in government, then they're going to be corrupt, they're going to take bribes, they're going to take as much money as possible, they're going to line their own pockets as much as they can. After all, who cares about selflessness? I mean, by being selfless, that's like a recipe for a bad life, If I'm selfless, people are going to walk all over me. People are going to abuse me. There's no real joy in that. That's how the selfish person thinks. But actually, it turns out to be the exact opposite. To be selfless, really, truly selfless, is the greatest joy that you can experience in life. And that's something that is very difficult to appreciate for a selfish person. Almost impossible. You have to really experience it for yourself to see that your life is so much more rewarding when you're not living it for your own personal gain or for money or for sex or for anything like that, but that you're living it to contribute to the world, to just do good for good's sake, to help people, to love, to be creative, to be whatever, in the purposes of something larger than yourself. And also a lot of people get this wrong is they think that, oh, well, Leo, if I'm going to be selfless, then that means people get to walk all over me. But see, what they don't realize is that the selflessness, it can be that way, but then eventually the inflection point hits. And actually, when you get past that inflection point, you're so selfless that actually you acquire some selfish tendencies, which is like you don't let people walk all over you. You actually have boundaries because your boundaries are there precisely so that you can be effective in being selfless. See, because if you were selfless with no boundaries, you actually couldn't be effective at contributing to other people because they would walk over you. And if they walk over you, then you're not effective at being selfless. And then, of course, selfishness can also loop back around. For some people, they need to go through this entire process of being extremely selfish in life, and only later in life, after years of selfishness and greed and corruption and all this sort of stuff, finally they hit this inflection point where they realize, like, oh my God, I've been so extremely goddamn selfish that now, one day you just wake up and you're like, that's it. I surrender. I'm going to be truly selfless from now on. And from that point on, their life becomes beautiful. Their life becomes about contribution. It's no longer about themselves. And this is a reformed person. This is a born-again person. But see, most people don't realize that that inflection point is there to be crossed from both sides. Now, not always is the inflection point crossable from both sides. In some of these examples, it is. In some of these examples, it only kind of works one way. It's asymmetrical. Let's take a look at the next example, freedom versus discipline. This is a really interesting one. Of course, everyone loves freedom. Freedom is so easy to love. You want to be free. You want to have your own time to do whatever you want to do. You don't want to work for your boss. You just want to sit at home and do anything you want. You want the freedom to travel anywhere, think anything, do anything, say anything, buy anything. But that's not true freedom. People who like that kind of freedom are usually very opposed to discipline. And they think of it as being a linear spectrum with freedom here and discipline here, and they're the polar opposites. But is that really how it works? What if by being disciplined, you actually develop more freedom? See, when I tell you to do stuff like set up a daily meditation habit, read books, eat healthy food, self-inquire, contemplate, you know, do all this other kind of stuff, it sounds like, oh man, Leo, that's discipline. You're telling me to discipline myself, pursue my life purpose, wake up every morning and do the mastery process and do the deliberate practice and all this other kind of stuff you talk about. But what about being free, Leo? That stuff is all like so grindy and it seems like so forced. I just want to be free. That's how life is meant to be. But see, when you go straight for freedom, it's the same problem as with the hedonist. Actually, that strategy fails. You become lazy and soft, and ultimately your entire life collapses. And you find yourself just having to like struggle and stress to even get the basic aspects of your life to work. Whereas if you're disciplined and you put in all these practices, meditation habit and your life, working on your life purpose and eating healthy, going to the gym and da-da-da-da, doing all this stuff, working hard, following through on things you got to follow through on, what you find is that you actually find a paradoxical freedom in that. Not at first, but the more you go down the circle and then you get closer to that inflection point, eventually you can come to the point where you become so disciplined that in that you get a ridiculous level of freedom that the person who is chasing freedom cannot even imagine, let alone realize. Very interesting how that works. How about empiricism versus mysticism? A lot of scientifically and rationally minded people would like to think that empiricism and mysticism are two ends of a spectrum, and that we have like hardcore science on this end, and we have fluffy, airy-fairy mysticism on this end, and then something in between. But what the empiricist doesn't realize is that actually all that mysticism is empiricism taken full circle. When you become so empirical, when you become so hyper-scientific that you question every single assumption, and you become so conscious and so aware of every single experience that you're having right now, that all concepts start to dissolve and break down. The past no longer exists. The future no longer exists. Atoms no longer exist. An external world no longer exists. A brain no longer exists because you realize these things are all just concepts. All of it breaks down because you're becoming so hyper-conscious and so hyper-empirical that eventually you hit the inflection point and there's this moment of inversion where you go from empirical to mystical. And everything that you thought was material and physical, it just in an instant becomes magical, divine, and mystical and spiritual. And that's all that spirituality is. It's just hyper-empiricism. But the scientific and rational mind doesn't understand that because it thinks in terms of this linear spectrum. It doesn't anticipate the paradoxical curving back around, coming full circle, that is actually possible. Now, this would be an example where it doesn't work in both ways. It works on this end of the circle, but not really on the other end. You don't become so mystical that then you become empirical. I don't know if that makes any sense. So it's definitely sort of asymmetrical in this example. The next example I have for you is nihilism versus meaning. So again, these are set up on a spectrum, and people think that there's nihilism on this end, which is dark and brooding and depressing, and it's like existential angst and like philosophers like Nietzsche and stuff like that who believe that there is no meaning to the world and nothing matters and everything is the same. You can kill people and rape people and none of it matters. And then you have on the opposite end, you have the people who are really into meaning and purpose. And these might be like the stereotypical religious people, like maybe your church pastor or something like that. And this guy is all about meaning. He finds meaning in his family. He finds meaning in religion. He finds meaning in God. He finds meaning in his government. He finds meaning in his nation, in his patriotism. He finds meaning in rooting for his sports team. And, you know, he finds meaning in all this sort of stuff. And it seems like they're totally opposite. But what if you take nihilism all the way? All the way past the inflection point, what'll happen? You become so conscious that there is no such thing as meaning, that everything in one moment flips upside down, and all of a sudden everything becomes extraordinarily meaningful. How can that be? Well, because see, the problem with nihilism is that it's really just a half-assed enlightenment. The nihilist thinks that nothing has meaning, but that's just a thought, that's just a belief he has. And then he interprets that negatively, he gives it a negative meaning without realizing that he's doing it. So he gets depressed and he gets lazy and he thinks there's nothing to do and life isn't really interesting and it's not beautiful because he just had this stupid belief that everything is meaningless. And then he interprets it as being negative, which is what? That's a meaning. So actually, he's not realizing that he's not taking meaninglessness to its ultimate conclusion. If he did, he would eventually circle back around past the inflection point, coming full circle, to realize that actually, you know what? Being has way more meaning than meaning could ever have. And then he derives all of his meaning from just being. And that becomes so much more powerful and amazing that it appears from the outside to other people that he finds so much meaning in everything in life. But really, what happened is that he truly became conscious that nothing matters and that there is no meaning at all. And to the person who is really into meaning, this doesn't compute. Because to them, you know, they find meaning in all these material and physical and spiritual ideas and concepts and things. But what they don't realize is that all of that is just a fiction. All the meaning you derive from your religion, from your country, from rooting for your sports team, from rooting for your political party, from tribalism, from all your ideologies, from your family, all that meaning, all of that will get wiped away. And it's very easy to wipe it away. And you can do that very easily just by destroying the guy's family, destroy his business, destroy his political party, destroy his nation. He is going to become hopeless and dejected more than the nihilist, because really all his meaning was just a mental fiction. And he didn't realize that what he needed to do is to let go of all that, actually move around towards nihilism, complete the nihilism, don't just half-ass it, and then eventually you break through and then everything becomes being, which is a million times more meaningful than meaning ever was. That's a really interesting example that a lot of people don't understand. How about amorality versus morality? I've alluded to this before in my morality videos. So again, they're put on opposite ends of the spectrum. You have the really moral people, which are usually the more religiously inclined people. And then you have the sort of amoralistic people, which are more of like the rational, scientifically minded, atheistically minded people. The really moral religious people, they believe in a strong sense of good and evil, that good and evil are objectively true. And the amoral people, the atheistic people, to them, they recognize that, yeah, good and evil, these are subjective notions, human notions, culturally dependent notions. It's more relative for them, whereas for the moralist, it's more absolute. But actually, what both these people don't realize is that this goes full circle. So if you take your amorality completely full circle and you realize that actually, truly, there is no good and evil, everything will become good for you. Now, the atheist will say, well, Leo, I do recognize that. I don't believe in an absolute good and evil. But see, that's just lip service. You're just paying lip service to amorality. That's not true amorality. Because if I steal your car, if I abuse your son and daughter, if I do something nasty to you, if I piss in your soup, what's going to happen? You're going to call me evil very, very quickly. You're going to think of me as evil. That's why you're going to get angry and upset and offended and hurt and sad and all this sort of stuff. That's why you'll lash out at me. That's why you'll call me names. Of course you will. Because even though in theory you don't believe in good and evil, in practice, of course you do. Because you haven't taken your amorality full circle. If you did, what you would discover is that actually evil is literally impossible. And that everything that you think is evil is actually good. And this notion is so difficult to understand for most people that they think I'm just kidding here. Or they think this is impossible. Or they think this is insane. No, it's just you have to cross that inflection point. That's a big hurdle to cross. But when you do cross it, you know what you become? You don't become Hitler. You don't become a terrorist. You become a saint. People don't get this. What do you think a saint is? Do you think a saint is someone who subscribes to traditional morality, who is behaving saintly because the Bible told him so, because God told him so, because it was passed down from above? No. A true saint, the only way you can be a true saint is if you realize that everything is absolutely amoral and that you are free to be any which way you want. And then what you do is you decide, I'm going to be good just from the goodness of my own heart for the sake of being good, just because everything is good. there is no such thing as evil in the saint's eyes. That's why he can be so good precisely to the most evil people, to whom you could not be good otherwise. Because if you think someone is evil, you can't be good to them. Which is why you can't be a saint. Which is why ordinary people are not saints, because they're not conscious enough to be saints. To be a saint is not just to be a nice person. To be a saint is to be conscious that literally nothing can possibly ever be evil or bad. That's what it means to be a saint. Now, the moralistic person doesn't get this. To them, this sounds absurd. They think they can get to sainthood by just putting layer upon layer of rules and should statements and morality upon themselves, because they think that morality is something that you have to obey in order to get into heaven, in order to get treats and prizes, in order not to be punished. But that's not true morality. That's actually amorality masquerading as morality. All of that is a fiction. So what the moralist needs to do is actually he needs to surrender his morality, go towards amorality, complete the full circle, come back around, go past the inflection point, and then he has a chance of discovering what true morality is. True morality is what I was describing with the saint. It's when you realize that actually everything is good. There is no evil, no matter how you behave. And from that realization, then, you will tend to behave in a very saintly manner, although you're not going to be bound by it. You're not going to have to. You're going to want to, which is the whole difference between someone like Jesus, who was a true saint, who had true transcendent morality, and your typical priest or preacher or pope who doesn't have this, because that guy did not go through the same inflection point. He didn't come full circle the way that Jesus did. So they're emulating Jesus, but the way they're doing it is completely backwards. And they don't understand this. And they don't know why it's not working. And of course, then you look at the Catholic Church and why Catholic priests abuse and molest children, that sort of stuff. Why aren't they moral? Because they're going about it the opposite way. They're telling themselves, I should not have sex. No, what they should do is to say, I can have sex all I want. And nothing's wrong with sex. And then they'll come full circle. And then they need to go even further past the inflection point. And then they could actually really be the kind of saints that they strive to be. But there's no way they can do it now. It's really not a matter of will. It's a matter of consciousness, which they do not have. The next example. No purpose versus strong purpose. I talk about life purpose a lot. And some people criticize me and say, oh, Leo, but there's no such thing as purpose. So why are you talking about life purpose? In fact, you made this whole course of life purpose, but isn't your whole course delusional because there actually is no such thing as purpose? Again, what you don't realize is that before I even created the course, I knew that there's no such thing as purpose. It's not a mistake. I didn't make a mistake. What we're doing here is we're going past the inflection point. When you realize that there is no purpose in life, you would think that, oh, that means I'm so lazy, I got nothing to do, I'm just going to sit and watch TV all day. I mean, you could, that is an option. But generally what happens is that when you fully realize that, then it flips back around and you suddenly realize, hey, I can design my own purpose. Oh, that's way more powerful than going out there and finding a purpose written down in some book. People think of it as though, like, because I created a life purpose course, people think that the way the life purpose works is like this. It's like there's a God somewhere and he has a database. And in this database, God has two tables. One has your name, a name of every human being that ever lived. And the other has a column there with the life purpose matching up to the name. And that what you're going to do is you're going to go, like, take the course and then match up your name to the database column and row with the life purpose, and then you found it. But of course, that's not what I'm saying. That's not how it works at all. Life purpose begins with the recognition that there is no such thing as purpose, that all paths are pointless. They all ultimately lead to nothingness. And that's not a problem. That's not a bug. That's a feature. That means you get to choose your own path. You choose the path you love the most, the one you're most passionate about, and then you commit your whole life to mastering that path. And counterintuitively, by realizing you have no purpose, you develop a very strong sense of purpose. People say sometimes, oh, Leo, but enlightened people, they don't have a purpose. Are you kidding? Enlightened people have the strongest purpose. Who are the strongest visionaries and the strongest leaders throughout history that have been remembered for thousands of years? Who are they? Jesus, Buddha, Mahavira, Gandhi, various kinds of saints and mystics throughout time. They've had the strongest purposes, which is no accident. Do you think those people realized that their purpose is completely pointless? Of course they did. Of course, that's precisely why their purpose was so strong. Next example, weakness versus power. A lot of power-hungry people out there in politics and business, in the military, and they assume that they can get power over other people. And that to get powerful, what you need to do is you need to acquire more force, more capital, more money, more military arms, more weapons, that sort of stuff, more technology. But what they don't realize is that that's not true power. Because they think of power as being here on this end of the spectrum. They think of weakness being over here. But actually, the way that it works is that, you know how you become the most powerful human being in the world? You relinquish all desire for power. That's the trick. Because as you become more powerful, actually, you find yourself being quite weak. Think of it, a dictator who has total and absolute control over his country. Is he powerful or is he weak? Can he sleep well at night or not? He can't, because he's worried that he's going to get assassinated. He can't even eat his own food. He needs someone to taste his food for him first, because he's afraid he's going to get poisoned. That's what power gets you. Counterintuitive, isn't it? On the other hand, when you relinquish all your power, what happens? You surrender everything so much that you have nothing to lose. When you have nothing to lose, you are in the strongest position of power that you can possibly have. The more you have to lose, oddly enough, the more can be taken away from you. But when you have nothing to lose, what can be taken away from you? Nothing. A couple of stories from history come up in mind here to illustrate this point. Well, first of all, you've got Gandhi and the incredible movement that he started with his non-aggressive, non-violent protests, and how powerful that was. He brought down the entire British government through just sitting around, going on hunger strikes, and that's it. He just sat around and went on hunger strikes. That was his whole power. He was sitting around in a loincloth and just a white sari or something like that, ate basically nothing, had no weapons, had nothing, yet he was able to mobilize hundreds of millions of Hindu citizens to ultimately overpower the British rule there. And the British had weapons and guns and power and all this sort of stuff, and eventually it all crumbled. There's also the story of Diogenes and Alexander the Great. And one day, Diogenes was just was basically a philosopher who lived out in the streets in a bathtub in Greece. And then Alexander the Great, who was this great emperor and great king, he strides through town. Diogenes is just sitting outside of town, and Alexander the Great stands before him, and he asks him like something like, so are you the famous philosopher Diogenes who lives in a bathtub? And he's like, and he tells Alexander the Great, he says, you're blocking my sun, because he's sitting there under the sun. He's trying to get some sun rays, some suntan, I guess. And Alexander's like, how dare you, speak to a king or to an emperor in this way? And Diogenes just doesn't care. He doesn't care because he lives in a fucking bathtub with dogs, surrounded with dogs. He lives in filth. He doesn't care. He has nothing to lose at all. reminds me of a similar story from Japan, or I guess it might be China, probably more like China. A Zen parable, where there's this Chinese emperor who's a warlord, and he's ransacking and conquering all the territory. And then he conquers one territory, adds it to his empire, and he's the greatest, and everybody is submitting to him. All the lesser warlords are submitting to him. And he conquers this one territory with this little Zen temple. And he asks all the priests there to submit to him and to pledge loyalty. And one of them refuses, the Zen master. And so the messengers come back to the emperor and they say, well, this guy, he's being an idiot. He's not submitting to you. And the emperor says, what? This fool, I'm going to go there with my sword and cut off his head myself. And so he goes to the temple and he finds the Zen master sitting there in meditation. And he tells the Zen master, he's like, you fool, you dare to defy the emperor? I could cut off your head without blinking an eye. And the Zen master replies, I could die without blinking an eye. And at that point, the emperor gets it. He realizes that the true power lies with being able to die, not with being able to kill. That's what takes real courage. And so he relinquishes his whole kingdom and he becomes a disciple of the Zen master. See, so power and weakness work in very counterintuitive ways. The next example is introversion versus extroversion. This is an interesting one. People tend to think these are opposite and that they don't connect. But actually what's possible is that you become so introverted that it circles back around and actually you become completely extroverted. How does that work? Well, you contemplate and you self-reflect so much that you actually become conscious that there is no mind or no interiority at all to human beings. See, as an introvert, you think you're stuck in your head all the time. You think you're self-conscious. You think you're stuck in the mind. Whereas for extroverts, they're out there. They're in the physical, tangible world. But there actually is no interiority to the mind. The thoughts and emotions that you're having, they're part of the external world. So when you realize that, when you realize that there's nothing on the inside, it's all outside, then you actually become literally an extrovert. Because you live completely out here. Your thoughts, if you have them, your emotions, if you have them, you don't consider them interior things. You're not hiding inside of them back there somewhere in your skull. They're out here. They're part of the physical world, you see. But all these dualities of inner world, outer world, physical world, non-physical world, all these dissolve. And what you're left with is just one thing. And you might say, well, that changes nothing then, but actually changes everything because for an introvert, they're stuck in their head. And they actually believe that's real. They think that whole world is real and it's not. And I'm speaking as an introvert. I'm a very strong introvert. But I realize that it's possible to actually go past this inflection point to extroversion. And that's also actually the ultimate solution for introverts is to go all the way around. Of course, you can also try to go this way as well. You can push yourself to become more an extrovert just by pushing yourself to talk to more people. And I've done that too, and that's a great strategy. So by no means am I saying you only have to kind of explore one end of the cycle. You can explore multiple ends sometimes in some of these situations. How about the divine versus the mundane? People think that there's like everyday life, which is mundane, and then there's divine supernatural stuff, which either doesn't exist, or if it does exist, it's some lofty, airy-fairy thing out there. But again, they don't realize that actually these are exactly the same thing. How do you get to the divine? You examine the mundane so much that it stops being the mundane. You stop taking it for granted. And at that precise moment, you pass the inflection point, and the mundane, everything you see around you, the most ordinary things, a piece of trash on the sidewalk becomes filled with the light of God. It becomes divinized. It becomes spiritual. People don't get that. People think divine means somewhere up in heaven in the clouds in the afterlife. Nothing could be further from the truth. Everything that's experienced right now, everything right here, everything you're seeing, this is pure divinity happening right now. The question is, are you conscious of it? Or are you just so asleep that everything to you is just, it's just like every other day? See? When it's like every other day, you're not seeing the magic of reality the way you did when you were a child, for example. That's just because you've become so acclimated to it. You take it now for granted. Life and death also cycle back around. You think that life is the most important thing and death is the worst possible thing. Nothing could be further from the truth. Your death is the greatest thing that could possibly happen to you. And the sooner you can die, the sooner you can start to live. People don't realize that. People who are preoccupied with life actually spend most of it trying to avoid death. And so their life is miserable. How about duality versus non-duality? Oh boy, this is a really interesting can of worms. This is a real mindfucker. People think that these are two things on a spectrum, two poles. You've got duality here, non-duality here. But what is that but a dualistic way of looking at the world? You see, that itself is coming from the perspective of duality. From the non-dual perspective, this loops back around. From the non-dual perspective, there is no difference between duality and non-duality. You get that? If you're into non-duality and you're opposing non-duality with duality, you're actually not being non-dual, you're actually being dual. You get that? It's really easy to trick yourself. To be truly non-dual is to be accepting of duality as well. To realize that duality is literally non-duality. They're the same thing. It's a matter of perspective. Whereas from the dualist's mind, everything is always a duality. They can't see the non-duality in anything. How's that possible, Leo? Everything is dual. Everything is separate. Everything is this. It's inner world, outer world. It's black, it's white. It's existent, non-existence, all that. See, they can't see past that. They can't see the commonality. And shallow forms of non-duality, like if you're doing consciousness work, you're doing enlightenment work, maybe you had a few glimpses, you think you've seen non-duality, and maybe you have, but still, you're putting them in opposition. It's like, well, my amazing mystical experience, that was the non-dual. And this thing here, now I'm in the dual. And so there's the non-dual and the dual, and I'm in the dual, and I want to get to the non-dual. How do I get to the non-dual? See, but that's all dualistic. When you're in the non-dual, there is no difference between the dual and the non-dual. They cycle back around. How about knowing versus not knowing? People spend most of their time trying to know more and more and more, acquiring knowledge. And I think by knowing more, that's the best thing. And then opposite of the spectrum is not knowing. By not knowing, you're admitting a weakness. That's like something is wrong with you. But what they don't realize is that actually the more and more and more you know, actually the stupider you get, in a sense. And if you would actually turn that around and go and start to unlearn, let go of stuff that you think you know, let go of all your models, all your ideas, all your beliefs, unlearn all that stuff, empty your cup completely, what you'll get to is that you will get to a point where your not knowing is so great that you then become conscious of the only thing that can be known, which is that everything is unknowable. And that is the ultimate place to be. And you cannot get there through knowing, you can only get there through unknowing. How about the duality that people create between the personal and the impersonal? So maybe you've wondered, is life personal or is it impersonal? If you're a religious person, you tend to think it's personal. You have a personal connection to God. You have a personal connection to other people, that sort of stuff. God cares about you. Whereas if you're an impersonal, scientifically minded person, you think that, oh, well, it's just all atoms and molecules. It's just materialism. There is no personal God. Nobody cares about you. The universe doesn't care about you. There's nothing personal about reality. Don't take things personally. To take things personally would be subjective human bias. But what both these people don't realize is that in truth, reality is so impersonal that it's utterly personal. It goes full circle. So if you take your impersonalism all the way around, you will realize that everything is truly so impersonal. And then you go past the inflection point that then the impersonal nature of reality becomes very personal to you. You develop a personal relationship to the impersonal aspect of reality. And that's really what the religious person is trying to get to, but doesn't understand that you can't get to it through this side of the circle. You want this personal connection to reality, but what you don't understand is that that's your ego. That's the thing that's actually blocking you from getting to what you want. You surrender the ego. You get rid of everything subjective. You get rid of all your self-biases, all your petty egoic clinging, all your ideas and all that stuff. And then you wind up being so impersonal that then you realize, oh my God, all of reality is truly impersonal. And then that becomes your one true personal connection to everything. How about the distinction people make between subject and object? They think that these are two opposite things. Like, that's an object over there, that chair, and I'm a subject over here. So the subject is looking at the object, and there's like the subjective experiences and there's the objective world. This sort of duality is set up. But what people don't realize there is that, again, they connect behind the scenes. And actually, it's possible for your experience, your subjective experience of an object, to become so subjective that it flips back around and you actually literally become the object that you were looking at. The subject disappears. The subject and object, they collapse. And therefore, everything subjective becomes objective. And scientifically minded people, they wonder about this. They say, well, Leo, your ideas of God and all that, aren't they just subjective? That's because you're thinking in this linear fashion. You're not realizing that it connects back around. Yeah, my experience of reality has been so subjective that I've been able to experience the absolute by actually literally becoming the object, which is the absolute. So through absolute subjectivity, I've gotten to absolute objectivity. Whereas actually you, as a scientific person who thinks he's trying to be objective with your empiricism and all your tests and all this sort of stuff, and your double-blind experiments, that's actually the most subjective. That's a completely subjective, human, species-specific method that you're using, and it will not get you to objective truth. You want objective truth, you can only get to it through pure subjectivity. If you try to get to objective truth through objective methods like science, you don't get to objective truth. What you get to is you get to human truth, which is what science is. It's a human-centered way of looking at the world, which scientific people don't understand because they're under the illusion that it's objective when really it's not. Sure, it would be helpful to realize this, wouldn't it, for many scientists? How about solipsism? A lot of people think, oh, Leo, enlightenment, that's just like solipsism. All you're talking about, no brains, you're talking about everything being hallucination, other people not existing, that's like solipsism. But what you don't realize is that solipsism goes full circle. So solipsism says that you are the only one who exists in the world, and you cannot be sure about the existence of other minds and other consciousnesses, other human beings. But the reality is far stranger than that. The reality is that even you aren't really real, and that there's no difference between you and other people. So when you discover that you yourself aren't real, your solipsism goes so full circle that you discover that, oh, I'm not real, and everyone else is also not real, so we're the exact same nothingness. So literally, the nothingness in me is the nothingness in you. So it's not that there aren't other people. It's just that all people are all couched within the same nothingness. The same nothingness is looking through my eyes as is looking right now through your eyes at me. But to realize that, you got to take your solipsism full circle. How about skepticism? I've talked in the past how people misuse skepticism very easily. Skepticism goes full circle. Most people, they like to be skeptical, but not really. They don't take their skepticism to the absolute level. If you take your skepticism all the way, it comes back full circle. You become skeptical of your own skepticism. Your own skepticism defeats itself. But see, most people, they don't really self-reflect enough to see and become skeptical of their own skepticism. And then that becomes a trap for them. How about being ordinary versus being unique? A lot of people try to be unique and special. And counterintuitively, in trying to do that, actually, you become quite ordinary. That's like those kids in school who try to be nonconformist all together. So they come up with their own little group, which ironically all conform to the same stupid things. And the opposite of that is that if you actually try to be ordinary, completely yourself, completely ordinary, that will actually make you very unique, because most people are trying to be unique and special. And the one thing they can't accept is that actually they're ordinary. How about the example of the true self versus no self? People who study mysticism, religion, and non-duality and enlightenment, they get very confused by this. Some schools like Zen and Buddhism talk about the truth of no self. There is no such thing as a self. And some schools like Advaita Vedanta or some Hindu traditions talk about the true self. So which is it? It seems like they're polar opposites. Are there two different truths? No, it's the exact same truth. No self is the true self. When you realize that there is no self, what does that leave? That leaves behind nothing. And that is the true self. Conversely, if you realize the true self, which is nothing, what do you discover? That it's nothing. No self. Exactly the same thing. How about nothing versus infinity as a distinction that people make, which is false? They think that nothing is over here, non-existence is over here, and existence or infinity, everything is over here. So either you can have nothing or you can have everything. Can't have both. Actually, they're identical. They're exactly the same thing. When you truly have nothing, it's so empty that it's infinitely full. And when you have infinity, it's so full that it must be empty. In the same way that if you take all the positive integers and all the negative integers and combine them together, you get zero. But inside that zero are contained every possible integer. It goes full circle. How about relativity versus absolutism? People like to rag on relativity. And they say, oh, well, there's moral relativity and that's bad. And there's cultural relativity and valid. People talk about relativity. Postmodernism talks about everything is relative. Everything is just, you know, different cultures, different values, but no one set of values is better than another set of values. And then the opposite of that is absolutism, which is you think that, oh, this is the absolute. There's the absolute truth. There's these absolute values. There's the absolute right and wrong. There's this absolute way to live life. That's the best. What's the truth? Well, the truth is that everything is absolutely relative. Reality is so relative that it cycles back around past the inflection point, goes full circle, and you discover the one thing that is truly absolute about reality, which is that it's completely relative. And people don't get that. People want to be absolutists, or they want to be relativists, but they don't take their relativity far enough. And when they're stuck in absolutism, they refuse to acknowledge that reality is groundless. And so they get stuck there. When really what they need to do, the absolutist needs to go from absolutism to relativity, beyond relativity, transcend relativity, and cycle it back around to absolutism. But this is a different kind of absolutism. For example, I've experienced the absolute. And the absolute, I know, is that reality is completely relative. But that's very different. My version of absolute is very different from your fundamentalist Christian's version of the absolute, or your fundamentalist Muslim's version of the absolute. It's the difference between the absolute in practice and the absolute in theory. Because when you realize that everything is relative and nothing is truly absolute, but relativity itself, then you don't cling to it. You don't need to defend it, which is the whole problem with absolutism, is that people who are absolutists in ideology, they need to defend their ideology. Whereas when you really experience the absolute relativity of reality, all of that flies out the window. How about this example? Doing nothing versus taking action. Some people who really love success and are ambitious business people, they are A-type personalities. They don't like doing nothing. They don't like meditation. They don't like sitting around. They don't like contemplating. They don't like philosophy. They like to go out there and take action and do this and build a business and kick people in the ass and da-da-da-da-da and all this. And as you're doing all that, taking all that action, what are you telling yourself? That you're accomplishing so much. But counterintuitively, the more action you take, the more you spin your wheels. If you would actually sit down and do nothing, if you would just meditate, if you would just look inside, if you would just look at the being that is right here, that would be the biggest action step you could possibly take in your life. But see, people think doing nothing is just being lazy or watching television. That's not doing nothing. I mean truly doing nothing. Truly doing nothing is some of the hardest work you can do in your life. I dare you to sit for 1 week and do nothing from morning to night for 7 days straight. That will be the most you've grown as a human being in the last 10 or 20 years will be accomplished in those 7 days. Just by doing absolutely nothing. And also notice how difficult it is to actually pull that off. Very, very difficult. Very counterintuitive. How can you accomplish so much by doing so little? And conversely, how can you do so little by doing so much? Interesting paradox. How about this other example? Ego death versus strong personality. Some people don't like enlightenment because we talk about ego death and they say, oh, well, the self is going to die and I'm going to realize there is no me and no self. And they think, oh, okay, so if that's the case, then there goes my personality. There goes all the stuff that I love in life. There goes my charisma and all of that. What they don't realize is that actually to experience ego death, you go full circle and your personality flowers. People who go through ego death have the strongest personality, the most charisma. They're the most spontaneous. They are the first to laugh and not to take life seriously. And taking life seriously versus not taking life seriously, another one of these examples. Because what people say to me sometimes is they say like, Leo, but aren't you taking life so seriously? Why are you taking life so seriously? Like, relax, man. Just have some fun. but you don't understand what I'm pointing you towards. I am pointing you towards exactly that. The person who is relaxing and having fun and all this, this is actually the person who actually is the one who takes life too seriously. Because when shit hits the fan for you, you'll get serious real quick. Whereas the enlightened person, the person who actually works on himself seriously, does the self-actualization, does the consciousness work, he will become so conscious that everything will become an illusion to him. Everything is a hallucination. So there's nothing serious to take. So you can laugh about anything. You can laugh about death. You can laugh about all the evil and corruption in the world. You can laugh about it. You cannot do that when you take life as a joke. Because as soon as someone pisses in your soup or steps on your toe or encroaches on your ego, you're going to get very serious very quickly. The only way to accomplish that is to go through ego death. How about masculine versus feminine? This is very interesting. This is actually a little insight for you guys doing pickup, trying to get better with girls. See, when you get into pickup, you think that, oh, I suck at attracting girls. The way I'm going to get good at attracting girls is by being more manly, more macho. That's what girls love. And you try doing that and you notice that actually it doesn't work. And if you do pickup for a long time, eventually what pickup leads you to is to the realization that all that pickup is really doing is that it's teaching you how to act more like a girl. That's it. Surprise! Girls are actually attracted to girly behavior. Here's all of pickup boiled down to one thing. Act more like a girl, and girls will flock to you. What does that mean? Be more emotional. Be more charismatic. Be more spontaneous. Be more flirtatious. Be more outrageous. Be more unpredictable. Be more moody. Show your emotions more. Wear them on your sleeve. Love stuff. Hate stuff. Be expressive. That's how girls are. Don't be self-conscious. That's how girls are. But see, that's not what you like. You as the guy think you're going to stroll into the club and you're going to act all macho or like some James Bond guy. You're the James Bond guy. You're so cool and so suave. You don't smile. You're not spontaneous. You're not flirtatious. And then you wonder why the girls don't flock to you. Well, of course they don't. Of course not. Because to really be truly masculine is to be comfortable with your feminine side and being able to express it. And girls love that. They love it. Girls hate a serious guy. How about this next example, attachment versus detachment? This also goes full circle. Best example of this, I would say, is neediness. When you are truly needy and you really need something, your chances of getting it are actually diminished. And when you're detached and you don't need anything, actually your chances of success in getting that thing increase a lot. This is true when you're negotiating. It's true in business. It's true with attracting girls. It's true with many facets of life. How about success versus failure? It's very interesting that if you want to be very successful, you need to fail a lot. Fail so much that you succeed. And conversely, oftentimes when people get very successful, they get complacent, they get lazy, they start taking their success and their practices for granted, and then that leads to their failure. It's oftentimes very hard to keep up success. How about this other example of rationality versus paradox? Rational people assume that rationality is over here, and on the opposite end of the spectrum is paradox and contradiction and irrationality. But as we've talked about in the Strange Loop episode, actually, these two come together. If you become so rational that you become conscious of the mechanism of rationality, rationality becomes conscious of itself. Rationality recognizes that actually rationality contradicts and undermines itself, and that rationality itself is a paradox. When rationality recognizes that, rationality transcends itself and goes beyond rationality. Rational people have a very hard time getting this because they're stuck in their rationalism and they don't turn the rationalism in on itself in the same way that the skeptic fails to do that and gets stuck in skepticism. How about suffering versus peace? This is an interesting one. People assume that they're the opposite thing, but actually for many people in life, they have to go through a lot of suffering to ultimately get to peace. And a classic example, this you probably know, is Eckhart Tolle. You know how he became enlightened, you know his story. He was on the verge of suicide. He was so depressed and so miserable, had so much suffering that it ultimately led to his ego death. He went past the inflection point and now he's in total peace. Now, I don't recommend that as a strategy. That's a very painful strategy and it doesn't always work. But for some people, you know, their path through life is a path of deep, deep, deep suffering. And then that's what they got to go through to ultimately get to peace. And if that's you, hey, that's fine. You can do it that way. I don't recommend it. I think there's easier ways. That's personally not my path. I don't want to go down that road. But, you know, there's many ex-addicts, for example, who have gone through very tortuous paths in life, lots of suffering, and ultimately came out very wise and peaceful in the end. How about stupidity versus wisdom? Seems like these things should be polar opposites. And yet, a lot of wisdom seems like stupidity to most people. That's why Zen masters and yogis and saints and mystics, they usually keep to themselves. Because if they start talking a lot, they start sounding very stupid and people misunderstand them. And I see that all the time. People on my forum post stuff like, oh, this yogi said this and this guru said that, but it sounds ridiculous. It sounds stupid. It sounds crazy. Yeah, because you're not nearly conscious enough to be able to decipher the profundity of his wisdom. So to you, it looks like stupidity. So in most of these examples, as you can see, the mistake is often not going far enough. Like with skepticism, the skeptic isn't going far enough with his skepticism. The introvert isn't going far enough with his introversion. The person who is suffering isn't going deep enough into his suffering. The person who's rational isn't going deep enough into his rationality to discover the paradoxes that lie within. The person who's committed to empiricism isn't being empirical enough to realize that actually empiricism leads to mysticism. The deconstructionist doesn't realize that his deconstruction is only linguistic and that it needs to go further to deconstruct itself as well. The person who's being philosophical isn't realizing that his philosophy doesn't go deep enough. He's just philosophizing in his mind. His philosophy isn't touching his way of life, his behavior, his very being. The nihilist isn't going far enough to realize that nihilism ultimately becomes enlightenment. The atheist isn't going far enough to realize that his atheism ultimately becomes God. A person doing nothing doesn't realize that he's not doing enough, do nothing. The person who's failing doesn't realize he's not failing enough to get the success he's after. There is this tendency for us to think of life as being linear, like these simple spectrums. But actually, life is much more interesting than that. Life tends to twist back on itself. It tends to reverse itself. It tends to have surprising twists in it. It tends to be counterintuitive, tends to be mindfucky. And your mind, and the purpose of this whole episode, is to make you a little bit more open to being flexible enough with your mind to embrace paradox. See, the problem with ideology is that it sets linear expectations. For example, the religious person will tell me, but Leo, I can't be God. You're talking about the self, me being God. You say you're God. Yeah, I am God and you are God. Of course you are. But for the ideological religious person, this this can't work because their notion of God is a very linear notion of God. They have these expectations. So for them, God could be anything, but he can't be me. And that's exactly what God is. Or likewise, they'll say, well, Leo, surely God can't be nothing. Because see, that's a linear expectation set by their ideology. But of course God can be nothing. What else could God be but nothing? Nothing is infinite. Nothing is eternal. Nothing is the source of everything. Of course God is nothing. But those linear expectations that have been set by your ideology prevent you from being flexible enough with your mind to realize that. And a scientifically minded person will say, well, Leo, empiricism can't be mysticism. Empiricism rules out mysticism. Again, that's a very linear notion of what empiricism is. That's what they taught you in school. That's what they taught you in university. But all they taught you is how to think inside of a box. You need to be much more flexible to see the non-linearity of life. Same thing with logic. It's like, Leo, logic can't have paradox and contradictions in it. What kind of logic is that? That's not logic at all. Yeah, because you're thinking of a logic inside of a little box. Because your mind, up to this point, hasn't been flexible enough to deal with the twisted reality of what logic is. And if you investigate all of these things I talked about very, very deeply to the very periphery of them, you will discover this looping back around that I've talked about. You will discover that your little box, which society has given you to think about all these things, it's just like a little handy rule of thumb. It's good in many circumstances, but it's not good enough to get you to the most deep and profound aspects of life. And that is that. Please remember to click the like button for me if you like this episode and come check out actualize.org. That's my website. You can browse videos easier there. My blog is there. I'm posting a lot of stuff. My book list, the forum, the Life Purpose Course, all those resources and more resources to come in the future that you'll want to check in with periodically to see as I update the website. I'm working on it all the time. And the last thing I'll tell you is just to really take this work to the next level, you got to start to read books. Yeah, my videos are good, but it's not enough. Not nearly enough. This is just an introduction. What I talk to you about is just an introduction. I want you to go read the top 100 books on my over 200 book list. Read the top 100. That will completely change your life. That will take everything I talk about and make it so much clearer for you, so much more persuasive, and it'll give you and show you tools and techniques for actually how to start working on this stuff. So if you're watching my content and you're feeling lost and you don't know what to do, and maybe you're even feeling kind of lazy and you don't know, like, well, I don't want to go out there and do something really big and difficult, but you want to start doing something, so at least start reading some books. Now, if you're already reading books, then I encourage you to push yourself to the next level and maybe start a meditation habit and so forth. But if you're just starting off and you're feeling stuck and you're feeling like you're procrastinating and nothing is working, nothing is clicking, go read a high quality book. Books are not frivolous things. Books are powerful, powerful things. Where do you think I got most of the stuff I talk about with you? Books. I don't just read a book and then just regurgitate the information that's there. I think about it. I contemplate it. I try to do exercises. I practice it. I get ideas. I get inspired by it. All that stuff comes together in this kind of concoction or soup in my head, this melting pot in my head. And then eventually, you know, new insights form and everything cross-pollinates. So you got to get that process working for yourself. If you are too lazy to read 100 books in order to master your life, to master non-duality, to understand personal development, to understand how business works, how emotions work, how relationships work, if you're not going to read 100 books, you've got no chance. You have no chance of making self-actualization work for you. You cannot make this work just purely by being lazy and watching my videos. or for that matter, watching other people's videos alongside mine. That's still not enough. You got to read the books. There's detail and depth in those books that could never translate into a video or even a series of videos. So add that to what you're doing and then start taking action on the stuff in the books. Get inspired by that stuff. Of course, take notes on those books using your commonplace book, which I hope you have set up now. And see, you're going to start to see all these pieces coming together. And then my videos will just be like commentary and extra bonuses on top of the stuff you're reading in your books and all the other practices you're doing. And then that's how you actually start to get the really juicy results that are possible here. So go and at least start doing that.